This program today with Susan Eisenberg is in conjunction with her exhibit, which is in the main gallery on the first floor. And there are a number of co-sponsors of that, including the MSU Center for Gender and Global Context, the MSU Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Initiatives, the MSU School of Planning, Design, and Construction, the Clerical Technical Union here at MSU, and the Union Coalition here at MSU, as well as Local 665 of the IBEW and the National Electrical Contractors Association Local Apprenticeship Board. So we're very, very happy to have Susan here. It's been an exciting week. We had 75 people at her poetry reading Wednesday night, including probably around 20 tradeswomen who were there to talk about their experience. It was fabulous. We opened yesterday on Super Bowl Sunday to a hearty crowd of tradeswomen and others who came to see us open that exhibit in the main gallery. And today, what we're going to do is we're going to start up here with Susan talking for a while. Then it very well may be that we take some questions here, and then we will peel out for the gallery so that we can do a quick walk through that exhibit so everybody can see what we've got going on the first floor. Susan Eisenberg and I first met a few years ago in Pittsburgh at the Working Class Studies Association meetings. And I was a fan of her poetry prior to that time, so it was an unbelievable experience and pleasure for me to finally meet Susan. Susan originally was here in Michigan when she was an undergraduate at the University of Michigan with our own John Rivette back at that point. She was a student activist and other things before she went on to be one of the first women in the apprenticeship program in this generation of 78. There was a whole group that entered the building trades and construction trades in 1978 in response to a strong initiative from the Carter administration to really open up the trades, and she'll tell you more about that in a moment. But since that time, she was first a woman electrician. She also is a blogger, a mixed media artist. She's a poet. She's an oral historian. And, Susan has done it all. And she is so creative, so well-spoken, and just so clear about what she's doing. And I think you'll find that today, both here and in the way that her show, On Equal Terms, makes a statement. So she's already mic'd. I'm going to turn this one off, but why don't you all join me in welcoming Susan Eisenberg.
Thank you, John. So I'll try to follow that intimidating introduction. It's been a real pleasure to be here. So I'm not only did I go to undergraduate here, I'm from Cleveland, so it's really, you know, kind of nice. I've been living in Boston for many years, so it's nice to be back here in the Midwest and to bring the On Equal Terms exhibit here. And I really have been just appreciated all the warm support that's been here. So I'm going to, you know, it's hard to get the nutshells of what to talk about, but I'll give like a, I'm going to just assume that we're all, since this is part of John's Brown Bag series, that all of us in this room are trade unionists and that we're kind of starting from those assumptions that, and if those aren't your assumptions, you'll just have them for the, you know, the hour. So that, you know, because we're looking at some of the contradictions within the labor movement and looking at some of the discrepancies between government policy and outcome. So it kind of, the issue of women in the trades has been, you know, kind of hit at a lot of contradictions that exist and dilemmas. So I'll try to give a brief sort of nutshell of why the issues has been important and why so much effort has been gone into it, and you know the history and and then a little bit about my own work and some of the elements in the installation, and then we'll go and look at it too. So there are some things that I added for the show. So it's, the work for me is always evolving, and I'm in interaction with a lot of a tradeswoman movement, and so I'm a insider outsider or person. So conversations that I have with tradeswomen around the country always shift the work that I do and inform it. But a lot of the work was informed by a book that I did that Cornell published called We'll Call You If We Need You, that for which I did interviews with 30 tradeswomen around the country. So let me just say really briefly for people who are, might be not so familiar with this history. I kind of think of it going back to really the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, which, really established the link between economic issues and political issues, and saying that economic rights were inseparable from political rights, and I think a lot of kind of created the moral ground for all the work that follows. And then really the Civil Rights Act created the legal ground for ending discrimination in the workplace. And that, Title VII in 64. And then what we see in terms of the women's movement, the feminist movement, looked at the discrepancy between, the income disparities between men and women, and really took two approaches. One, to elevate the work that women did that were traditionally female work. So I don't know if anybody else in the room was born before 65, as I was, but I grew up, with the newspaper want ads, help wanted male and help wanted female. So that ended legally with the Civil Rights Act, but it has still cast a long shadow, and we really see still a continuation of not only occupation of women in particular, dominating particular occupations of men, others, and surprisingly, the ones that are predominantly male have, tend to have higher pay, et cetera. But even within occupations, there's those stratifications. So what followed, because construction, has often had a lot of federal funding, because it's like 4.9% of the GDP is construction work. It's a really significant sector of our economy. That became a target for affirmative action. There were executive orders under Johnson that set goals for hiring minorities. And then he expanded affirmative hiring to include women, but he never set, in the 60s, there were never set any goals for women to be hired in construction. So there was a lawsuit in the mid-70s from a variety of women who were working in the trades and advocacy groups against the Department of Labor. And in response to that lawsuit, is why Jimmy Carter issued, two executive orders in 78 that established hiring goals for women on construction sites that were 7.9% as of, or 6.9% as of 81, and goals for bringing women into apprenticeship programs equal to half their representation in the workforce, so that women should have been 25% of apprenticeship classes. I came in 78. I was in a CETA program before that, training women in non-traditional occupations. I called up in December of 77 the man who became actually a very dear friend and my apprenticeship director, to find out how to become an apprentice electrician. I was told, he was very frank. He said, the unions don't want you, the contractors don't want you, we'll call you if we need you. In April 78, when these guidelines were issued, I got a call on a Friday, come in Monday for an interview. So for me, it was always very clear, what affirmative action did. And I would say the women who came from my generation of the pioneers really experienced strong affirmative action. There were, you'll see in the installation, copies of the Department of Labor posters that were seen everywhere on, billboards, bus stations, recruiting women, encouraging women. So you really felt like you were part of a movement that was really changing the workplace. There were monitors that came out to job sites that checked on hiring. So the women who came in at the very beginning had a certain expectation that what to me like affirmative action, as opposed to like the Rosie the Riveters, you know, kind of said, not like you have this job while nobody else wants it or can't be here, but you have this job because you're entitled to it, because you're deserving of it, you're qualified, and you have the backing of the government behind you. You kind of, and the movement of the times. That was short-lived. If you remember, Carter went to Reagan, you know, and much like what happened with OSHA, like things didn't go off the books, but they just stopped all the monitoring, so effectively it ended. And I would say we didn't really quite catch on for a while, you know, that nobody was that much behind us. So there's been that sort of legacy, you know, kind of since then. And what a policy that initially should have led to women, you know, years ago by now being 25% of the workforce, you know, if you had been 25% of the apprenticeship class carried forward, you would become 25% of the workforce. Coincidentally, the government, you know, calls a non-traditional occupation an occupation where one gender is less than 25% of the workforce. So it was really kind of to end, you know, construction as a non-traditional occupation for women. Instead, what we've seen is since the 80s, women have been roughly 2.5% of the workforce. So kind of started this thing of move the decimal point there, you know, to go from the 2.5% to 25%. So to not look at, you know, small little changes of, oh, let's fix this little thing or that little thing, but really the policies were meant to be dramatic, to really give women access to these jobs that are great jobs. And I think that's been, you know, part of the challenge is, you know, I worked in construction for about 15 years. And you know, it's great to be able to go, you know, buy a hotel and or a, you know, a hospital and say you put that up, or you know, with my kids we'll say what we worked on together when I was pregnant with them, and there's a real satisfaction in having those skills and you know, being able to shape the skyline of a city that you're living in. You know, and these are jobs that people can do that have high school diplomas and get on the job training, so they're really good and important jobs. So that's the draw to bring women in, you know, to open them up to everybody. You know, and some of the history that's happened has really raised questions of, you know, is that responsible to do that? And is that a false, you know, is that a theoretical idea that these are good jobs? You know, does that really work out in practice? Let me just say, because what we've seen is that women, you know, tend to work as apprentices but not be employed at journey level, still have to fight for access to, you know, equal training. So there's a lot of kind of ongoing issues that have made made these not the successful careers that they sound like. So that by union contract, we always get, you know, everybody gets the same hourly rate. But if you're, you know, construction is contingent work, so that you're, you know, working on a job as it's going up, and then, you know, there's layoffs, you know, workforce shuffles. So if you tend to be in the, you know, hired because they need to hire a woman, or, you know, not the welcome person, not the person seen as in the core workforce, you might be making the same hourly wage, but that might not translate to the same annual wage or the same wage that ends up in your pension years. So, you know, we have, last August we reached the point where we were a third of a century since the 78 guidelines, which were in, you know, kind of August 2001. So it's a time when women are, who started early on, are, you know, would be reaching their pension years, you know, and I think that really throws out a real question of how do women's, you know, careers match men's careers, you know, even for the women who are successful. So I've, for many years, these were kind of, what I find for myself is I kind of shift how I've looked at this. So that very early on, you know, I was very sort of eager and earnest, and really believed that it was part of something, of something that was really changing. I'm going to read a poem from that. That really represents to me like the earliest years. Hanging in solo. So what's it like to be the only female on the job? On the sunshine rainbow days, womanhood clothes me in a fuchsia velour jumpsuit and crowns me with a diamond hard hat. I flare my peacock feathers and fly through the day's work. Trombones sizzle as my drill glides through cement walls, through steel beams. Bundles of pipe rise through the air at the tilt of my thumb. Everything I do is perfect. The female of the species advances 10 spaces and takes an extra turn. On the mud-cold gray days, on the mud-cold gray, no sun in a week days, womanhood weighs me down in colorless Arctic fatigues, hands me an empty survival kit, and binds my head in an iron hard hat, three sizes too small. I burrow myself mole-like into my work, but my Tampax leaks, my diamond tip bit burns out after one hole, my offsets are backwards, all of my measurements are wrong. At each mistake, a shrill siren alerts all tradesmen on the job to come laugh at me. Everything I do must be redone. The female of the species loses her next turn and picks a penalty card. On most days, those partly sunny days that bridge the rainbow sunshine days and the mud-cold gray days, womanhood outfits me in a flannel shirt and jeans and hands me a hard hat just like everyone else's. I go about my work like a giraffe foraging the high branches, stretching myself comfortably. As I hang lighting fixtures and make splices, I sing to myself and tell myself stories. Everything I do is competent enough. The female of the species advances one space and awaits her next turn. So I guess the work that I've been doing, and in a way that the installation comes out of, is looking at that discrepancy between sort of the expectation of the policy, and not only that, but and the outcome, but also what people, women who I've talked to thousands of women in the trades, and I've never met one who felt that 2.5% was any real reflection of women's ability or interest. When people have done studies of when there are really jobs, there are always women available to, and interested in doing them. So it's not a, to me, a question of interest or ability, but it's a question of looking at the institutional obstacles, which is the other way to, the other explanation. And I think what's been sad to me, partly as a trade unionist, is that there's really, the problems have all been known and well documented for a very long time. There's a something down in the installation of testimonies that were given in hearings and about racism and sexism in the building trades in New York City in the early 90s. There's all kinds of studies and stories that have been, recounted. So it's not from lack of information. Maybe when I first came in, that might have been true. But it's certainly, as the decades pass, not a question of lack of information about the problems, but lack of really strategies to solve them or the will to solve them. And what's kind of struck me, particularly a case that happened about 2 years ago in Oregon when a woman line worker, a member of my union, was denied her journey card as a line worker, even though she was highly qualified. She had to sue to earn her journey card, to get her journey card. Even with that, in 2010, was the second woman to become a line worker in the state of Oregon, which we think of as a more progressive state. And she had faced sexual violence and physical violence on the job, and even in her home, people came to her home and did threatening things like, you know, damaging her truck, you know, where she lived alone with her daughter. So, you know, you kind of think, this is really just about a job. So that happened around the same time as the meltdown of the nuclear power plant in Japan, and around the same time as the Southwest Airline, I think, flight that had the roof kind of fly off mid-flight. And it made me, kind of highlighted for me the difference of how, you know, really I think the issue around civil rights is, do we relate to civil rights failures? And I think that's really what this is, the history of women in the trades is about, a civil rights failure or unfulfilled civil rights. It's not about just, you know, non-traditional occupations and interesting women in an unusual career. It's about a failure to really carry forward on civil rights. And the fact that, do we relate to you know, a case like this woman, line workers, what happened to her in Oregon, does that cause an alarm to go off? You know, kind of what's the difference between something that sets off an alarm versus something that sets off, oh well. And we find that there's an incredible repetition of the stories that women have in the trades, and that's because either they're not dealt with or they're dealt with as an individual case, but not, you know, when the nuclear power plant was melting down in Japan, everyone was going, you know, I think the four things that happen when you're kind of in that alarm, you know, there's an alarm sounded, people want to know exactly what happened. You know, you really want the specifics. People want to know what was the systemic failure that allowed that to happen. They want to know what could prevent that in the future, and how do you create a watchdog to, you know, to make sure that that's happening? You know, because everyone want to know, like, well, where is the nuclear power plant closest to where I am, or the plane that I'm going to get on? Are they like those? What we find with, I think, civil rights violations, that it doesn't set off that kind of alarm. Like, what does that, you know, how do we reevaluate the whole training and, you know, the system that produced the failure for Jenna, so that it doesn't happen somewhere else. So I think that's to me the challenge, you know, as an artist, as an oral historian, as an activist, of how do we move things from, oh well, to alarm. So what you'll see in the, what I'm excited about the installation, and I hope it really gets used, you know, kind of while it's up here by groups, is because I think, you know, unlike like something that you read on your own at home, it's a social event to have something in a gallery. It's a place where lots of people can be in there at the same time and have a conversation. And I think this is, you know, kind of controversial material and a problem that we haven't solved yet. And that what I particularly like about installations is it kind of reproduces life in that, depending on where you stand, you see different things. Or it can also have contradictory experiences at the same time. And I think the experience of Women in the Trades has been very contradictory, of people love the work and want to encourage other women to come in and, you know, have a lot of cautionary tales and want to put up warning signs and get caught in between that. I'm going to just say a couple of, because we were the gallery is a larger space than it had been in before, and because a number of things happened, I added three elements to the show that you'll see in the back gallery. So let me just say a little bit. The installation started really an early version of it in the early 90s, because when I was starting to work on the We'll Call You book, and I very specifically started that book because I was concerned at the way that the kind of that 2.5% was getting analyzed, you know, that it was being used to show that, oh, women aren't interested, and that just wasn't, or capable, and that just wasn't my experience. And also, well, anyways, so just some of the stories were so troubling that a friend of mine just said, like, you need to get it out of yourself. So I started kind of physicalizing it in the installation and created Stella, who you'll see downstairs, who's a figure with a life-size woman on a ladder wearing the old Carhartt that I used to wear working outdoors, and the diamond hard hat that's from an image from the poem that I read. And on her are tags that tradeswomen have filled out since the early 90s of ways that they felt labeled on jobs. Because I was going to be here in this larger space, and also because I was, I added a couple of things in the back room, and one of them, because I was at the Seattle Women in Trades Fair in the last spring, and I was given the welding suit that you'll see hanging there that belongs to an operating engineer, Vanessa Downing from Seattle, who was just weeks away from finishing her apprenticeship and was killed on the job on a barge on the Seattle waterfront when she was crouched over welding and in the blind spot of the crane operator so that when he turned, the ballasting hit her in the head. And she was it was an accident, and she was very beloved and someone for whom the apprenticeship had, she'd been kind of a model apprentice because she'd come from the streets of Seattle, a runaway who, the apprenticeship had really, I think like it has done for many people, kind of helped her organize her life, and she was a really star, apprentice, and also it helped a lot of other young people who were living on the Ave to get into apprenticeships and very successful apprenticeships. So, it was a tragedy that hit people in Seattle particularly hard because not that much before that, a woman electrician had been electrocuted on a job there, and it was sort of part. So I felt a responsibility being given. It came from her mom to kind of. There wasn't really a place at the time for that in the installation, so I wanted to expand the installation to have a place for that. So I added something about deaths on the job, and. That became a much more complicated story than I, the whole that a task than I had expected, and a lot of the stories were more troubling, than I had expected them to be. I'm going to read a poem that. What I ended up doing was going back to people who had told me about someone who had committed suicide or somebody who was, had an accident on the job, and, to try to get their names and date of birth and date of death for the to add to make tiles. And you'll see that down there. And the blank tiles are where, the people knew the story but not yet the name. But three of the names that are there were kind of recovered from the process of working on this show, including one from Cleveland, Rocky Huastas here from Cleveland, a carpenter, and she contacted me because I put this sort of call out. I said, this is what I'm doing, and she said, I know there was a woman who was killed in doing highway construction in Ohio. I don't know her name. I don't know exactly the story, but I know there's a story there. And we tracked down the story of a woman, Debbie Kane, who was a in the laborers union in Cleveland for 15 years, and what we found out was that she was working on highway construction and killed by the a truck delivering materials to the site, and a state rep who in the Ohio state legislature who happened to be also a member of that same LIUNA local for 30 years and had been an organizer with them was so moved at her wake that he put into the Ohio state legislature to have them change the name of the bridge, which is where she was killed, to the Union Workers Memorial Bridge. So it was kind of a very wonderful story, and we found her name. And that was really from Rocky's suggestion. So there are a number of stories like that. I'm going to just say maybe a couple of the other. How are we doing? Let me just look at how we're doing on time.
We're doing fine.
Okay. But kind of what happened with me and Rocky of this happened in Cleveland, was happening or with people around the country. Melinda Nichols, a carpenter in Seattle and head of the apprenticeship for the state of Washington now, said, why don't you include Molly Matthews, who was a firefighter. So there are in Seattle who was killed. And then, that sort of opened up a whole other story. As you'll, there's sort of a handout down there that you can take about those. What it turned out happened with her was it was she was part of a big effort to open the Seattle Fire Department to women and minorities that began in 1980. There was a very concerted effort and very public effort, so that it was very. You know, unlike construction, where there wasn't really a lot of documentation of women coming in, you know, to the construction trades, there was a tremendous documentation in the archives of the Seattle Fire Department of women and minorities coming in 80 and the training that they had and how they expanded the workforce there. She was killed in 84, and that time there were 45 women in the fire department in Seattle, which was... significant, but the feeling among other women firefighters was that she was killed purposely in an accident. When she was always put on the outside, they would hang on the back of the fire trucks. At that time, they stopped doing that after she died. She was always put in the outside position, which is the most difficult to position to hold on in a turn. And there's sort of different stories of the official record says that they were going 15 miles per hour, but the sort of scuttlebutt that people felt that were talked about at the time was that it was more like 25 to 30 miles an hour, and that it was a deliberate to sort of throw her off. And what sort of reinforces that idea is that when I mentioned that to a woman in San Francisco, she said the same, very similar thing had happened to an African-American firefighter in San Francisco. So, but he hadn't, he had fallen, been thrown off, but had survived. The fire chief in Seattle, who had been very prominent in opening the fire department to women and minorities, left shortly after she died. He did a lot to prove that it wasn't that she was weak that she couldn't hold on, but he kind of went on the fire truck himself at that same corner, and said that it was a failure of the that it hadn't been her fault, but he left that fire department very shortly after, went to Houston, didn't last there a year. So clearly he was very troubled by the circumstances of what happened. Another story that I kind of went back and I thought I was really just asking for a name was I had been given a talk in Milwaukee in 1999, and a Chicano man had come over to me and said, did I know about this woman, iron worker from Kenosha, who had, and he told me the story that how she had two kids, she fell off the steel and died. She'd asked for a safety harness, told she didn't need one, she fell in an accident. But he was very agitated telling me this. So that's partly like, I'm someone who travels around and people tell me these stories. So when I was doing this tiles, because I had Vanessa's welding suit, I went back to friend Marge Wood in Wisconsin and I said, what was the name of that woman iron worker in Kenosha? Thinking I was really asking a simple question and thinking that she had, just fallen in an accident that was not anything particular. And that set off a whole conversation. Marge now works in the state technical college system, and Wisconsin just recently had their 100th anniversary of apprenticeship. They are the oldest apprenticeship program in the country. I don't know if that's disputed. that fair? So she sent out a question to all these people in the labor movement and apprenticeship program in Wisconsin to say, Susan Eisner is doing this installation, going to Michigan, and she's looking, wants to know the name of this woman. And at first, things would come back and go, well, I faintly remember a woman who was only on the job a couple of days as an iron worker getting blown off the roof to her death. It made the front page of the Milwaukee paper the next day, and at the time I thought it would only make it more difficult to get women into the ironworking trade or other construction trades. I didn't have an apprentice contract for her yet, so there's no paper trail with BAS. So people were very helpful, kind of, and this one was going to say, I'm going to see so-and-so from the ironworkers, I'll check it out with him. And what would kind of, so it follows through this thing that there was no record of this happening. So people kind of question, maybe it didn't even happen because there was no record in apprenticeship and no record with the ironworkers. Someone came forward with the name Robin Johnson. And then you know, from once we had the name, we could find the record in the newspaper. And what turned out was that she had been a pre-apprentice, a probationary apprentice, and that was a practice that they had that they also was eliminated, of having people in a one-month tryout period where you would, you know, kind of have to prove yourself in that first month. If you made it, you would be counted. That month would be accounted if you're apprentice, you know, for your apprenticeship. If you didn't make it, oh well. So what the woman who had her name was, said, Robin Johnson. She was working without fall protection, which was not unusual in those days. So that was why she was outside the system. So then when you look at the newspaper accounts, there's a lot of accounts about how it was a very windy day. So then what you start unraveling is that here you had a woman who was with two kids, you know, husband, two kids, who was 37 and sent out trying to get into the Iron Workers Union on a one-month tryout time and trying to prove herself, sent out on a roof on a windy day to do roof decking. To install metal roof decking, asked for a safety harness, told she didn't need one, and she sails off the roof. What also, if you look at the newspapers from that time, you see is that was kind of, oh well. 3 days later, a roofer on that same job fell through a couple of floors, survived. The next Monday, they had a safety meeting to kind of talk about dangerous hazards on the job. So that was a really harsh story to kind of for me and Marge to kind of find, because we recognized that any woman who really made it in the construction trades would have made the same choices as this woman, Robin Johnson, that we would have been, you know, trying to prove yourself. So she really was left with that choice of either going home and giving up the opportunity or doing what she was asked to do, and really would have been unaware just how dangerous that was. But certainly other people would have been aware of the conditions that, you know, she was working in and how dangerous that was. So this is sort of some of what Marge wrote to me. As Nancy Emmon said, that was before OSHA fall protection. In those days, no one wore safety equipment. I'm struck that Robin had no protection, legal, equipment, safety, culture-wise, and that she wasn't even preserved as an apprenticeship statistic. You know, so that here they had just had their apprenticeship, you know, 100th anniversary of the apprenticeship. Here was somebody who was a part of that history, but not even recorded. And then she also says, your choice in using, because I wrote something on my blog about this, on Ken's background and in the initial comments, I was just filling in the pieces. Ken did not draw a direct line between Robin's death and BAS cracking down on their selection process. So they did end that practice, but there's not a clear line between the way there was with Molly Matthews' story of how it ended. Regarding asking for fall protection, I can just imagine how hard it is for a pre to ask for anything that isn't part of the macho culture, you know, a norm of the time. So that was one story that was just particularly staggering for me, I would say. And then another one was one in California that where we don't have the name yet. I really was sure we'd get it by the time the show opened, because that was, you know, emailing back and forth all last week. But this was a story told to me by a friend named Molly Merton, who you'll see downstairs. There's lots of the 19 years of Tradeswoman magazines. Molly was really responsible for those, you know, that history network happening. So there was a woman in California who was ended up committing suicide after she was raped, going to be interviewed by a contractor for a job. And this took many, many months to recover this story at all. Molly had told me about it, you know, maybe 2 years ago when we were hiking, and she's, because she felt like it was a very emblematic story. And she thought these other people who had run the pre-apprenticeship training for women, an advocacy program for women, would know the story. She was going to ask them, but then she kind of said, no, well, you should ask them. So I would send emails and try to get them to respond, and it was just really asking them to look at very painful history, so I would get nothing back many times. So then finally, like about a week before I was coming out here, one of the women who ran this pre-apprenticeship program for women at the time said, send me questions and I'll answer the questions, like do it that way. You know. So she and another woman who were part of this pre-apprenticeship training for women, women in apprenticeship program, responded. So it turns out, so my friend Molly had thought the woman had gone through this program and been referred by them, because they were quite devastated by this history, and I knew that because I had interviewed one of these women earlier, and she was just sobbing, remembering it. But in fact, this woman had come through another program, but it was just kind of spoke to me about how that ripple of trauma, you know, kind of affects a whole community. So she was a Japanese American woman who was around 30 years old. I said, you know, ask if they could describe her and what drew her to construction or any, you know, that. Susie responds, she was a slight woman, maybe 5'5", slim, not skinny. She looked fit. I think she wore glasses, had black, short black hair. Not sure what attracted her to construction. At that time in San Francisco, we had more Asian women entering the trades because of our efforts and the efforts of others. There were Asian tradeswomen, and they formed an Asian tradeswomen caucus, Bobby. There was a group called Asian Blue Collar Women, ABC. Peggy Lum might have been involved in that. She's still in the East Bay. I could get a number for her if that would be of use. I asked what training or pre-apprenticeship training she had. They didn't know. I asked, did she get referred by a training program to a contractor? Susie, I think she was referred to the contractor by AOF, an apprenticeship outreach program in San Francisco that primarily worked with minority men. I asked, was it a carpentry job she was trying to get? So I knew some of these things from what I had heard, so I was just checking out, you know, from what I had been told by someone else. Did she have a hunting license from the Carpenters Union and was out talking to contractors? So the way the Carpenters Union, so if somebody who's an apprentice in my union, IBEW, if you're an IBEW apprentice, you're sent, the apprenticeship program sends you out to jobs for in the Carpenters Union. Partly the way they can take in a lot of apprentices and have seem to have high numbers in their apprenticeship is they're not guaranteed jobs. That gives you the hunting license that you can go out and find a job yourself. So you, that's sort of your responsibility. Yes, she was looking for a carpentry opening, and she seemed to have a hunting. She must have had to have a hunting license in order to look for work. I asked about the. And Bobby says, this contractor was known to hire women. So she went to a contractor that particularly was well-known for hiring women, you know, where there was access to jobs. I asked about the circumstances of the rape. Susie, from what she told us, yes, it happened when she went to be interviewed. The interview took place in the contractor's office, which was located outside of San Francisco. From what I remember, the interview took place after normal work hours, and she went by herself. Bobby, she went for a job interview in the evening at the contractor's office. Although this wasn't a common practice with most contractors, it wasn't unusual for that particular one. Asked what was the impact of her of the rape and the circumstances of the suicide and what year it was. Was it 82, which is what I had, you know, been told by someone else. Susie, she came to our office with a friend. And I thought this part was so telling about this woman's commitment to the tradeswoman community after she was raped. She came to our office with a friend. She was fragile but very courageous as she relayed what had happened to her. She was devastated that this could happen to her. Bobby, telling the story was obviously difficult for her. I would say she was distraught but completely believable. I think it was 82, but it could have been 81. I looked through my 81, 82, 83 calendars but didn't find any relevant notes. So people have done all this, like, you know, so what you see in the gallery downstairs, you know, is really the result of a lot of, you know, kind of movements of people all around the country trying to gather this information, you know, so that it could be here. So that's part of what I want to convey. We were all shocked because we had worked with this man for years, and he was a member of our board of directors. So even though they hadn't been the ones that sent her, he sat on their board of directors. She wanted us to know because she heard that he was on the WAP, which is their program, board of directors, and she was concerned for other women we were referring to him. Bobby, the man was with a large contracting firm that hired more women than most. Women continued applying to the contractor, but we began warning them to always go in pairs, go when other people were around, don't go after hours, etc. As for the suicide, I don't know the details of it, but we heard later that she had committed suicide while in Hawaii, which is where her family was. Bobby, I believe that there was some talk that the family might file a wrongful death suit against the man, but I don't know if they followed through. The impact on the trade zone community... when it was asked about the impact sort of on the larger community. Susie, impact for us, women in apprenticeship, we were stunned and not sure what to do. We did get him removed from our board of directors, and that was actually a very difficult process because the contractors kind of circled the wagons around him. The other contractors who were on their board didn't want him removed, so that was a huge struggle. We were more careful when referring women to contractors, urging women to go in pairs if the interview was at the contractor's office and not at the construction site. We became more cautious. I'm not sure about the impact on the tradeswoman community, especially the Asian tradeswoman, but everyone knew, and I'm sure other people could give more input on that. And then Bobby adds, I think we all felt betrayed by this man. He had been someone women in apprenticeship program had held up as a model contractor. I had personally vouched for him with numerous tradeswomen. Although we got him off the WAP board, he continued playing a large role in the California construction industry. And when I talked to one of the people who gave me some of this information Friday, she was so glad that this story and tile were included because she said it's still an ongoing issue for Tradesman Inc. That's in the Tradesman Group in San Francisco. They had just been asked to send women to a job in some remote place site in California, and they were just in a dilemma of what to do. Because women needed jobs. But was there would they be putting a woman in danger? And I think that's really where the whole institutional, responsibility comes. And that's Jenna Smith, the woman line worker in Oregon. Like, I had a breakfast with her dad, who's a retired Navy man. And his kind of feeling was, he's a great guy. He was, he saw the Navy change, and the Navy opened to women, and that it did that by, having very clear, regulations and clear repercussions. And he was kind of baffled why construction couldn't do the same. And he also felt like very clear that, 2% of the people, who are already vulnerable aren't the ones that can make change. It really has to be from the top, with people really being trained. I want to add a little thing, too, about there's a story that you'll see in the gallery. So in that back gallery are kind of, things that address that institutional responsibility. There's a bathroom shack with graffiti. Well, that's really the contractor's responsibility to have a workplace that's a non-hostile environment. There's a wall of stories underneath wallpaper that come from people taking great risks to testify in New York City, 90 to 92, on discrimination hearings that were held by the Human Rights Commission in New York City. Under David Dinkins, some people testified behind a screen with their voice altered. You'll see there's a testimony from Judith Schneider, a lawyer with Nadi Legal Defense and Education Fund, who was part of the lawsuit in the 60s, saying one of her client won't be coming because she's been threatened and her kids have been threatened, so she's afraid to come to testify. So at great risk, people testified. There was a whole set of findings, recommendations. Nothing at all happened. It was published in the last month of the Dinkins administration, went to Giuliani, but I think purposely by Dinkins. He wasn't willing to take the political risk to do that. So that sort of speaks to the government's failure to really, kind of step up. And then there's a story on the other side of a woman who was raped at a union picnic and went to her business manager for help, and he kind of, told her to forget about, make a big deal out of it. And I included that because I have found a number of stories, particularly of women apprentices, being raped or sexually assaulted and going to their apprenticeship director, their business manager, and getting a similar response. So, you know, and I think the union is who we most hope, you know, will kind of be, you know, lead the way, you know, as a sort of our moral kind of beacon. So I wanted to just open up those challenges with the installation, and I thought I would maybe end with a quote from my international president. And originally the title of this, I think, took a line from that, which I can't find. So this was done in response to the Jenna Smith case, really. I would say the initially, the union really, well, obviously they didn't step in at the, you know, while she was being harassed for years. But when the lawsuit was carried forward, the local union did step in. And then when it was brought to the international, you know, I mean, basically when like her lawyer said to the business manager, you know, like when the shit hits the fan, which side do you want to be on? But the international, you know, did step forward and really take leadership and play a very useful role in the case, you know, when they finally came in. You know, but that's sort of a question of, in terms of the alarm, like you don't want to wait till you get to that point. You know, so she got a settlement, but she lost her job. She's the kind of person that you just know belongs as a line worker. She just loves the work. She's, you know, did really well in all these rodeos. You know, she kind of... You know, when I was just kind of in that feeling of like, you should just be warning women away, you know, then I watched this video of her and I was like, oh, you know, you just want to support her to do the work that she has a passion for. So this is a statement that kind of is in a video, Inclusion for Everyone, that was produced at the IBEW International in response to that. And I think it just really, I guess what Jenna's dad would say is, you know, where are the actions that follow the words? But I think the words go further than I've really seen before. So I'll leave it, you know, with that question. So these are two paragraphs from his statement. As members of the union, it's also our job to improve the lives of working men and women and to make sure that everyone is treated fairly and equally in the workplace. Being part of the labor movement means each of us needs to work toward a day where every worker receives the same amount of respect, opportunity, and dignity. That day's not here yet. So I thought actually that was a huge step forward from, you know, earlier times when I could say an earlier president of my international, when the We'll Call You If We Need You came out, said that men and women are treated exactly the same in the IBEW. So this is a huge acknowledgement. That day's not here yet. Despite the progress that's been made, we still see cases where an IBEW brother or sister is treated badly for no good reason other than the fact that they are perceived as somehow different. It might be gender, it might be because of race or religion, it might even be because of job classifications. And when times are tough and many of our members are feeling the economic pressure, old prejudice can spring back to life. That's not acceptable, and that's not the IBEW way. And that's why the IBEW is dedicating itself to confronting issues of discrimination head on. It's why we're committed to standing firm against outdated and unfair practices of the past. It's why we're determined to rid our ranks of those who choose to treat others unfairly, for whatever reason. I thought that was just a really interesting statement. So I'm going to read that line again. It's why we're determined to rid our ranks of those who choose to treat others unfairly for whatever reason. And I think that's really the challenge, you know, of how do we, you know, it's really to me a question of domestic violence in the House of Labor and how do we address it, and, you know, how does local leadership address that among its membership? How does the international address that within among local leaders? How does the AFL address it among each other? You know, that when one union is not acting in a way that speaks well of the idea of fairness in the labor movement, would people cross that turf boundary and say something? You know, in the same way that we might feel feel, you know, that people didn't used to, if somebody was beating their wife next door or, you know, beating somebody in the street, you know, pull the shades down, that's not my business. You know, that's really, our attitudes around that have changed. We feel like we are responsible to, you know, call 911, not necessarily step in, but call 911, you know, like to sound an alarm, you know, when that happens. So I guess that's the, you know, to me, I think that's a question. I think he, President Hill, kind of raises a question of how does it really come out in action, and how to, you know, even, you know, in a university when you're hiring, you know, contractors, how do you enforce, you know, I could say that Harvard in Boston, there's probably not a tradesman in the Boston area who has not worked on a Harvard job, because they have always, you know, been very assertive about affirmative hiring on their jobs. The same is true of Cornell in Ithaca. You know, that could be something that MSU does. You know, but I think that's how do we kind of, you know, sound an alarm enough and respond to it as an alarm, and that we all feel responsible to address. So, so we can move downstairs.
We're hoping that you're willing to take a walkabout with us through the gallery, but if any of you have questions before we do that, I'd like to make sure that we get them on the page. So, questions, sure.
I drive a lot, and I'm stuck in traffic a lot, where I'm watching highway road construction crews. Almost 99% of the time, it's a woman holding the stop flag. And I know nothing about their relationships to their male colleagues. Is this a local decision that's made by the team crew leader that a person who's perceived to be weaker will stand and hold the flag for endless power, or is this perceived to protect her? I'm sure that they don't plan those women's shift times just when I'm stuck there, so I only see the women holding the flag.
Char is coming, so let's send the woman out with the stop sign.
Yes. Did you want to answer that? So actually, one of the tags on Stella is flagger.
I'm Russ Davis. I'm the state director for the Office of Apprenticeship. We have 8,500 apprentices in the state of Michigan, about 1,200 sponsors. It's one of the largest apprenticeship programs, federal programs in the United States. Addressing the question you just said, is that we have a program here with the state of Michigan and with a federal program promoting our road construction apprentice readiness for women and minorities. I helped set the right curriculum 4 years ago when I was at Delaware College. We are trying real hard to promote more women and minorities into the skilled trades. If you have a program today in the state of Michigan, you have over 5 apprentices, you do have to follow the EEO rules and the guidelines to promote, make sure that we are offering everything equally towards women and minorities. We're working real hard. We're certainly not there, just like you say, 2.5 or 25. And so, but we are working very hard at it, and it's a long ways to go yet. Part of the problem is that you don't know what you don't know. I think it goes back to our education. You look at public education today, where we don't even talk about manufacturing construction unless you go to a tech center. And a lot of times the tech centers are mostly boys or men, and if you think you go into the construction, you know you're kind of weird yet. But I was a tool maker for General Motors for 30 years, and we had about, I think we probably had 25 women in about 900 trades there. That's a very, very slim number. And so, anyway, thank you for a nice presentation.
Thanks. But yes, flagger is an unskilled, you know, it's not a road, a ladder to something else. So somebody's put there to, you know, that's not, it's a job. So, and that's the sort of the issue really is job or career, you know, and apprenticeship is meant to be a career path. So that wouldn't train you for a career.
Other questions or comments?
Just point in your experience in traveling around, familiarity with trades, businesses, owners of businesses who will front their business with their daughter or their wife.
Oh.
So they land contracts for, they minority-owned business requirement because they have their wife or their daughter's name. But I've just an interaction that I had with two specific companies that do that, even though the husband or the father is the actual person in the business, the name on the business is something else. I don't know if you have that experience with familiarity.
Sure. So that's somewhat different issue. So that's about set asides for minority and women contractors, so which is different from the workforce workers. But yes, so that's been an issue whether, for minority contractors as well, that the money might really be managed by a white contractor, but they'll have their sort of minority contractor or woman contractor, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be a relative. So that's certainly an issue. And all of these really are about, is there oversight, and are there consequences?
Other questions? Yes, Carolyn?
Thanks very much. Intersection of your work life as a construction worker with the art that you make, and how you see those two interacting and reaching different audiences, and how they interact in your life.
Well, so I'm not working in the trades now. I left working with my tools in '94, partly as a for many reasons, but I actually have an essay in the September issue of The Progressive partly about that, partly in response to a death threat from the about for activities of bringing attention to women in the we don't want you to stop doing what you're doing of bringing attention to women in the trades. It's bad for business. That came from the head of the Building Trades Council at the time in Boston. And I was working on the We'll Call You If We Need You book, and I just felt like I really needed to do that without that, anxiety about how to evaluate that threat weighing in. So that is one interaction. I was trained as a poet, I guess, before I came into the trades. I studied with Denise Levertov, and so really survived a lot of my apprenticeship by, writing poems about that experience, and really didn't think about it as anything beyond my own personal experience. I did a book that John has. It's a Good Thing I'm Not Macho came out at the end of my apprenticeship, and I was shocked when I got responses from people around the country, from other tradeswomen who would say, because I thought, okay, this might be my experience. Maybe the other four women who were electrical apprentices with me might have similar experiences. A plumber from Wisconsin would say that's exactly my experience. And it was just eye-opening to me. It made me realize I was really part of a, kind of cultural experience that people really shared. That there was a whole, that we really all had the same set of stories and experiences. So then it's, for me, been very interactive. Of people will say, tell me when. There's a poem downstairs, Pioneering, and I really wrote that in response to a reading I did in California where a firefighter said to me afterwards that she thought that my poems, which all the It's a Good Thing I'm Not Macho poems are, that I wrote during my apprenticeship are all kind of the way that you had to be then of like, nothing's too hard, I can't handle it, very... and she was like, just called me on that. That wasn't really accurate. So I wrote the poem Pioneering in response to that. So I'm, I guess, always learning, very aware that my own experience is both common. We all have a common experience, but also, where I stand has very much to do with being in Boston, which has a particular politics in the building trades. They are very different from, Seattle, which is a much more open environment. That you know, every difference, you know, people have different experience, you know, by their race, ethnicity, how tall they are, you know, so that it's my responsibility to kind of also incorporate all those things.
What I'd like to do at this time is, Rocky.
I just wanted to say briefly that I've known Susan for years, and those of you who have just met her and this whole issue, that trans women like us who rely on our jobs for our economic independence truly respect and rely on you, Susan, because of the work that you do in trying to change policy and bring this issue in front of the public, not knowing and having them learn what's going on so that they can be more proactive and possibly help. So thank you.
So why don't we thank Susan one more time? Why don't we start at this end, and we'll walk around with Susan. I have to do a bit of business, but... Why don't you just take
through this? Okay, sure. So they're just various element areas, essentially, of the show. So this is the kind of historic part. This Department of Labor poster for people who were around in the 70s, very familiar. And they were on, you know, buses and subways and just part of that, you know, you can kind of have that 70s look, recruitment effort. This is, there are 13 banners that are up here, and those were contribution from the Painters District Council 35 in Boston. They were printed, you know, by union painters. You see this is the beginning of the tradeswomen magazines, and you can see these are the early years, black and white. There were, they came up, so it's a quarterly magazine that came out from Tradesman Inc. in San Francisco, largely edited by Molly Martin for most of the years. And it was a, so there's some of them, they start here, then they get color later. Became too expensive to do the publishing and printing and mailing. But it was an incredible, you had like women all over the country who were, or in Canada, who were like working, the only woman on their job or the only woman in the union. And then like, you know, this magazine would come every couple of months, or often late, you know, it was like very, and it just connected people. People wrote, you know, contributed poems, photographs, articles, so there'd be a lot of discussion, and many people became dear friends of mine. I first met through those magazines. So all the banners also are quotes from Women and We'll Call You If We Need You, and I kind of did it by their name and rather than their trade, the city, so that you just had a sense of the that is a national interconnected movement. The title one comes from Melinda Hernandez, who's in New York City. She was in the first class of women in the IBEW in Local 3 in New York. And it gives a title for the show, you know, the ending with, you know, all these things are just fighting for your rights. But to them, it's radical because you're making them face the fact that you're here to stay and not on their terms, on equal terms. So it kind of raises that question of, you know, what does it really mean to treat people on equal terms? So there's some things that are kind of constructions, just you're on a construction site, like coffee break area, blueprint table, and this kind of area here is really being a tradeswoman as parents. So there's the cake, which is a quote from Kathy Walsh, the same woman who has this quote that's quite harsh, has, you know, my kids know which bridges in town are mine. She was a carpenter in Kansas City, worked on a lot of bridges. She actually happened to be at the opening that was at Brandeis with her son, who was lives in the Boston area, and her granddaughter, who was wearing the t-shirt that her son, who was a baby, one of the kids, which Ridge is, you know, wearing, like, I'm proud my mom's a union carpenter, but it was changed to grandmom. So I was like, that was really nice. So these are stories of tradeswomen as, you know, moms, and some of the story, like, you know, the phrases or letters are highlighted in cookie letters. Because I think often we, you know, kind of bring work home and bring our kids, you know, kind of our work, our kids sort of share in that experience. The hotel that I worked at, with my daughter, she ended up having her junior prom in that same hotel, which was just, you know, because we'd always, you know, say we built it together, so that was fun. This is Stella, who is, her faces are composite of tradeswoman faces, many from images from Tradeswoman magazine. These are She's wearing my old Carhartt suit. And the diamond heart, it's an image from a poem. I like the fact that she's pulling in cable. That means she has a partner. She's working with somebody. All of these are tags, and there are probably 100 more that aren't on her, have been filled out by tradesmen over the years of when I asked people how they felt labeled on jobs. I like, for me, the fact that I kind of tried to figure out how to do that tension of, diamond heart head, accomplishment, competent, up on the ladder doing your thing, and, those barriers, and settled on the tags. They're sort of like valve tags. So it had that construction site element for me, but it gives a chance of not prioritizing one over another, because for every woman and every situation that they're in, those might be different. And I like that it gives you that handwriting and personal testimony element of it. But should have been plugged in, excuse me. This is another construction site element. Okay. There you go.
Nice.
Yeah. Wow. These are photographs of just hands, skilled hands and women who do work. Over here, I added this element because somebody came to a show. There was a who recognized the poster and had wanted to have been a tradeswoman and wasn't, but she saw the hard hats in the gang box and asked if she could try one on. I said sure, and I figured other people would too, so I added an element of you could try on a hard hat. We had 100 Voc Tech students, young women from Voc Tech, 5 Voc Tech schools, come to shows in the Boston area, and we would do it as a conversation about their own programs. And I asked them, how they were encouraged or discouraged, and they filled out sticky notes of yellow for discouraged, green for encouraged, and one of them, you're never going to make it. Because if you're in a Voc Tech school, you're a Voc Tech teacher in your career track, that's your gatekeeper for that career path. So, when the comment is you're never going to make it, that just struck me so strongly, so I added that. And this is a couple of things here that are kind of like I think of as poet's mailbag. Is a letter that was sent to me in response to the We'll Call You book from a woman in Quebec about being a student in a Voc Tech school and being sexually harassed, even though she was at the desk right in front of the teacher and had to do the class not in the classroom, which, for a trade class, kind of ridiculous. So I wanted to include that. So there's a lot of elements of personal testimony. This is just a kind of a celebration of the tradeswoman movement. All the books and newsletters are all created by, come from different parts of the tradeswoman movement, Kansas City tradeswoman. So you kind of see that there was an incredible movement all around the country, incredible effort and energy to try to, on the part of tradeswomen, to try to make this successful. That just really wasn't, as Jenna's dad said, 2% of people can't, no matter kind of how valiant you are, how much effort that you yourself can't make that change. So these are more, you can see the magazines become more colorful. And these are just different t-shirts that either I had or people gave me, some that Rocky gave me, and some that are from, there's one from here, the purple one over there. And again, the banners are just all different kind of aspects of the experience. And then, more kind of celebration of tools. I feel like particularly for women in the trades, just that chance to really learn to be competent using tools has meant a great deal. This is from actually Helen Vlasenilik, who's a carpenter. She did her apprenticeship in Albuquerque, and now she's out and works for the Parks Department as an electrician in the city of San Francisco. So the tools kind of become sort of fanciful, have the sense of them levitating and becoming pinatas and. This is that sort of celebration of craft. And so in here, this is you know, some of what I mentioned about the tiles. So these are the ones that are blank, like the woman from the who was raped by the contractor and committed suicide, still a blank, because we don't have her name. And I did also, so both women who worked in the construction trades, but also from, like, you know, one representative of other trades who were, you know, affected tradeswomen. So, like, Molly Matthews is the firefighter from Seattle that was given to me by a carpenter in Seattle, you know, because that was just part, affected the whole tradeswoman community there. The 14 women here that are together are the from the Montreal Massacre. If people are familiar with that history, in December 6th of 1989 in École Polytechnique, University of Montreal, 14 women engineering students were murdered by a man who came in and had the women leave. Had the men leave the classroom, shot the women, went into three classrooms, and 14 women were murdered that day. It became a day. You can see on Stella's arm, there's an armband she has that's from that history. There's also a poster there from that time. So it became a day of action remembrance by the Canadian Labor Council, acknowledged, you know, against violence against women. So there's also handouts for that kind of to go into more of the deaths and things. So this is what I end up doing with the thanks to Gary Morgan and his wife who did the wallpapering, who's the director here. So this is I just put the some of the testimony from the pages and pages and pages of the, like the testimony is probably like a foot and a half of testimony from the New York City hearings, discrimination hearings. Some pages are just out there, you can see, and some are just under the wallpaper. So that sense of, you know, kind of under that veneer, you have that, all this testimony that, you know, in some ways just got papered over. Well, I'll say this is the the bathroom shack. So also there's three places in the installation, one in the bathroom shack, one by the gang box, one by the coffee break area, where you can hear tradesmen telling their stories that are from the interviews for We'll Call You If We Need You. And either you could do it if you have a smartphone with an app and do whatever you do, or you can dial up a number on the cell phone. And then, you know, kind of hear excerpts from that. This is a bathroom shack, 6x6, you know, and what I like about it, so it has graffiti in it that's, you know, documented from job sites, you know, from people taking cell phones or legal testimony or my own job. And to give people that experience of just that vulnerability that you could feel on a job. When you sit on the toilet, you can't quite reach the door doesn't quite lock. And, you know, so you can hear some of the harsher stories are in there and you kind of within that environment. And, you know, you could see over it if you were up on a ladder. So just to kind of convey that feeling. What I really have liked about it is that tradeswomen who come in, you know, have comments of like, what is there, a school for this? Like, I've seen exactly those things on my job. What is that? Or they'll go, you know, it's very resonant, but very, you know, tame. People, they would consider this tame. You know, whereas when it was up at Brandeis and people come in, they're like, you know, shocked. So that's been an interesting conversation in both directions, both for people who work in very different jobs to be see what's, you know, normalized on a construction site, and for people who do work on construction sites to realize, you know, kind of rethink what you've allowed to be normalized or, you know, had to deal with being normalized. So I like that it's kind of big enough, a couple of people can be in there at the same time. It's a conversation space. They do have warning signs since a lot of kids come in. Okay. So this is also kind of a poet's mailbag from a letter sent to me in response to the poem Pioneering. And it's the sort of fragments that start, that create a narrative about a woman who was gang raped at a union picnic, essentially. And worse than that, that she went to get, you know, kind of reported help and really wasn't, you know, kind of told to forget about it. And what was instructive for me about that is, you know, there's no names in this. I do know the name. And I asked somebody who I knew, you know, about the person, the business manager, really. You know, I said, do you know this person? You know, and she said, yes. Like, why? And I said, well, I've been given this story and thinking of using it in an installation. And, you know, and he's in it. And she was like, oh, you know, her assumption was that it would be a great story because he was a really nice guy. Kind of like the contractor, you know, in this story that I talked about earlier. And I was just totally taken aback because even, you know, still, like, I expected her to say, oh, it's evil, horrible. Which, of course, as soon as she said it, I realized, well, the story wouldn't make sense then, because if he was somebody who had a reputation as a horrible person, this young woman would have never, you know, at 20 years, you know, kind of gone to him for help and expected to get help. So, you know, it just spoke to me about the failure of people really knowing, you know, even a nice person being able to cross those, you know, kind of boundaries of friendship or know what to do, so try to erase it. So, you know, I'm still learning, you know, myself and have the same instincts of kind of wanting to make everything simple of, you know, kind of good person, bad person. And, you know, it is much more complicated than that. And then this is the kind of a, you know, kind of goes with the tiles. This is this Vanessa's Downing's welding suit from her mom and a poster that came from the time of the Montreal Massacre. The poem of mine, Remembering the Fire at Triangle Shirtwaist, that the story of Robin Johnson is in before I knew who she was or really how much more complicated her story was. At the end is a woman from Seattle who was electrocuted, and the memorial, that was from the Local 46, her local public, you know, did that celebration of her life. And the black t-shirt. Okay. There's some stuff on the other side, but so that comes from New York City, a woman, Bianca Kouros. And that's kind of part of what also triggered all of this, the memorial stuff. She was a safety inspector on a construction site in New York City and was being sexually harassed and molested by the elevator operator. If you think about it, on a high-rise construction job, if you have to, if you can't get along with the elevator operator or ride the elevator, you really can't do your job. She ended up suing him, his local, the Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, kind of many people. $20 million lawsuit for sexual harassment because she'd been laid off. He was kept. She, the day before that was case was to go forward, she died in a huge fire in her Queens apartment. Coincidentally, so a group of New York City tradesmen formed a group, Justice for Bianca, that I joined to bring attention to her case. And her 16-year-old daughter was at home and was in a coma for 3 days, and her 18-year-old daughter was not at home. She filed to become, you know, head of the estate, and she continued the lawsuit forward. So we wanted to, you know, kind of give them support until they reached a settlement, which I don't know the settlement was, but it, the case it did. So that comes from that part of the, you know, and that really got, you know, kind of reached out to nationally to, you know, and that, you know, kind of raised that whole issue of how do you sound an alarm, get help, you know, and what danger that might take on it as well. Anyways, I'm sorry, then I'll end with this. So this is kind of the, I just wanted to add another, you know, kind of reproduce the poster because they were everywhere. And this is a quote from Mary Michaels, an iron worker in L.A., who herself had a very good career. She retired from the iron workers with 30 years in, I think, and, you know, really worked well for her. But this is, you know, in the mid-90s, when I interviewed her for We'll Call You, she was already had thought women would be 15% of the workforce by then, you know. This section is, you know, I kind of think of it as a summary of the show of On Equal Terms, of just sort of asking... this is a, you can kind of, I'm sort of set up so that, like, depending, you can kind of figure out your own height. I'm 5'2", this 5'8", 6'2". So people have different heights. You know, what is the difference? You know, asking the difference between identical treatment and equal treatment. You can kind of see that the so it's kind of color, the color codedness of the ribbons follows through on the ladders, and you can see that the tallest person on the shorter ladder has the same reach as the shorter person on the 8-foot ladder, so 6-foot ladder, 8-foot ladder. So kind of raises that question of you know, really, what does it mean to treat people on equal terms? And it's not so simple as just, oh, I did the same for everybody. What's the problem? You know, because we can kind of see, doesn't really come out equally. So, any questions? And then, so I guess more flying tools, because they're just sort of fun, I don't know.
Let me just say, we'll take any questions here, and then there are books for sale upstairs. They're absolutely fabulous. Two collections of poetry, and the one, We'll Call You When You Need You, which is really based on Susan's oral history work. So do come back up to the gallery if you're interested in getting books.
Or sign, like, there's, I think, a comments book, too.
Right. And there's a comment book right out at the desk. But any questions about the installation?
So, okay. Welcome to Rome.
Wander around. We'll see you upstairs.